Welcome to Temple of Health Radio Show. This is Dr. Susan Kolb, and I'm pleased to have as my guest today Dr. David Hanskin, whose book, Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain, examines spiritual aspects of medicine that most orthopedic surgeons don't get into too much. And certainly chronic pain is something that gets patients' attention and often has a spiritual and consciousness component. Thanks for joining us today, Dr. Hanskin.
No, thank you. I'm excited to be on the show.
So you want to tell the listeners a little bit about your background and how you became interested in writing your book?
Well, I was in chronic pain myself for about 15 years, from about 1980 to 2003. And I'm an orthopedic surgeon, and of course we're geared to structurally solve different problems. And I started having chronic pain in 1988 with migraine headaches and back pain and neck pain. And I spent the next 15 years going into this spiral downwards. And I came out of it by luck, and it took me a few years to figure this out. But as I started to share my experience with my patients, people started to go to pain-free, of course, including myself. I've been pain-free for about 10 years. And it's been a remarkable experience. Prior to my own experience, I knew nothing about chronic pain. When I gave lectures to doctors on chronic pain, we're really not taught any of this in medical school, residency, or fellowships. So physicians become very frustrated about chronic pain, as do patients, because we don't really know exactly what to do. It turns out that chronic pain is a neurological diagnosis, and once you understand the diagnosis, it's extremely treatable.
So how do you go about evaluating someone who's in pain? What are the different things that you look at?
Well, as a surgeon, I always am extremely diligent to make sure it's not a structural problem. You know, occasionally people have cancers and tumors, infections, or they'll have pinched nerves and bone spurs. So I don't cut short the workup at all. In other words, I never assume it's a neurologic diagnosis. And most of the time, probably 95% of the time, we don't find anything structural. Then once I get that out of the way, I want to make sure for my peace of mind and for my patient's peace of mind that that part's covered. Then we just look at the situation, try to find out what's going on. And we find out, for instance, if somebody has a bone spur and they have sciatica, the bone spur has been there for years and the pain may have started 3 or 4 months ago. What I'm finding out slowly but consistently is that often when the pain starts, there's an extreme stress that occurred in somebody's life, loss of a child, spouse, loss of a job, financial issues, etc. And we know under stress that the body chemistry changes and the adrenaline and cortisol levels go up. We know in animal studies that the nerve conduction increases by 30 to 40% under stress. So what happens is the pain threshold drops and you feel pain more easily. That bone spur is going to be the first thing to light up. And what we found out, if we just calm people down for 6 to 8 weeks before we do surgery, we call it prehab, rehabilitation before surgery, that we've now had multiple patients actually cancel their surgery with structural problems.
Well, stress leads to more common problems with things like yeast and other chronic infections because your immune system is depressed.
Right.
And we all have viruses, and many of us have intracellular infections, and many of us have yeast and even mold. So these things go up, and I know yeast and mold will make one more acidic. When one's more acidic, then you're more likely to put down bone spurs. And also yeast depletes magnesium, and if your magnesium-calcium balance goes out of balance, then you're more likely to put down bone spurs.
Right. That part I'm not so familiar with, but I do know that under the acute stress part of it, when the bone spurs are there, that something changes because the bone spurs didn't grow overnight, and what you're talking about, of course, is the chronic part, which leads to those bone spurs forming. But, it's a topic where people look at their body like a machine, that there's a bone spur, and get it fixed, the pain's going to go away. And I keep reminding my patients that machines don't have pain. You know, there's nothing in the mechanical world that resembles pain or emotions or the body chemistry, et cetera. And, it's a very dynamic, delicately balanced system. But you're absolutely correct.
So what you do for bone spurs, if you don't want to operate, you know, we see bone spurs on the feet and different places in the body that for hand and foot surgery. And what we do is we make them more alkaline and we change the magnesium-calcium balance, and the bone spur actually goes away. It's very interesting.
Huh. Okay.
That's the mechanism, I think, how stress causes, you know, an increase in bone spurs. There may be other factors, but I think those are pretty much what I would say is the main cause of it.
Uh-huh.
So acidity is the enemy. It's also the enemy when you are setting people up to get cancer.
Uh-huh.
You know, people who are very, very acidic have an increased risk of cancer.
Yeah. There's a somewhat of a famous study. There's a Dr. Bernie Siegel, who's a friend of mine, who wrote a book called Love, Medicine, and Miracles. And those were in the 1980s. And he was, you know, the link between stress and disease has been documented for decades. But he pointed out one study that they took a group of college students and they gave them a happiness index. Then they measured their illness and mortality rate over the next 30 years, a very long prospective study.
Mm-hmm.
They found out if people were unhappy in college that their mortality rate went up 10 times over the next 30 years. It was mm-hmm. not a subtle difference.
Yeah, I'm familiar with that study. I think that people who are unhappy are much less intuitive. They're much less, you know, like their endocrine homeostasis isn't there. Like you say, they tend to be in lighter fight response more often. They get angry more often. They have negative emotions like fear.
Right.
And it changes your physiology.
Right. We also know in chronic pain, and many people don't want to hear this, that it's been well documented that in chronic pain that your nervous system or your brain physically shrinks. Fortunately, when you treat chronic pain successfully, your brain re-expands. So there's mm-hmm. very much real physical changes that occurs actually in the nervous system. The other problem is that with adrenaline, it actually shuts down the blood supply to the frontal lobe of your brain. So you're correct. There's several reasons why I think that people don't think as well in chronic pain, with obviously the pain being a distraction. But the blood supply to the brain shuts down with adrenaline.
Mm-hmm. That's true. Well, one of the most interesting things I've found in my practice is that people who are experiencing financial problems often have pain in the lower back. And like you say, no structural issues, except maybe if they're older, we may all have some structural issues as we age. But that the structural issue may not be the cause of the pain.
Right.
But it comes on very quickly when the financial issue comes on. And if the financial issue is resolved, it goes away
right.
with very little other treatment.
Right.
So how do you think that works? What do you think happens there?
Well, a couple things. There's a lot of things that we do not know about back pain, but we actually do know that bone spurs and disc degeneration have been documented not to cause back pain. In other
mm-hmm.
words, you take 100 people off of the street and do an MRI scan on them. These are people without back pain, and a high percent of those will have bone spurs, degenerated disc, herniated disc
right.
type thing.
Exactly.
And then at age 65 and above, it's almost 100%. In my practice, I see people pretty much every day that come in with sciatica with the bone spur pinching a nerve. Then we
mm-hmm.
look at their spine, there's bone spurs everywhere, but they don't have back pain. They have just the sciatica.
Mm-hmm.
My own situation, I've had two back surgeries, and I have no disc in my back, and knock on wood, I do not have back pain. So we think that back pain is probably a muscular problem or a tendon problem.
Mm-hmm.
And people don't realize that there's actually 1 million pain receptors per square inch in the body, which is a lot. So soft tissues hurt. So it's not like the pain's imaginary. This is severe, unrelenting pain. And the muscles in the back are large muscles, and they hurt. And when you
mm-hmm.
go into muscle spasms, it's just brutal when it comes to back spasms. So, yeah,
mm-hmm.
there's plenty of reasons for the back to hurt besides bone spurs. And then again, going back to the financial issues, I agree. When I had my back surgery back in 1985, I lost my job. And it's a bit
mm-hmm.
of a story there, but not being able to take care of yourself financially in a capitalistic society is a disaster. It's probably the most
mm-hmm.
stress I've been under ever, is not being able to take care of myself financially in this society. So again, you know, under that kind of stress, your body chemistry changes, then you change the pain
mm-hmm.
threshold, and then and that's where the back pain, I think, it's complicated. I don't think we get simplistic about this, but that body chemistry plus the muscles and tendons that could be inflamed anyway, plus just moving around during a given day, if the tissues are irritated, of course you keep moving and irritating your back. So it's a cycle. It all comes together.
So after you do your MRIs and your physical exams and everything, what sort of treatments do you put people on initially who have new onset back pain with no structural component?
Well, I think there's two different categories. If somebody has low back pain less than 6 weeks, we consider that acute, and we simply do medications and physical therapy and ice, heat, et cetera, to calm it down. Mm-hmm. If the back pain's there more than 3 to 6 months, we find out that the brain actually memorizes the pain circuits very, very quickly. So mm-hmm. when pain goes into a chronic phase, it's been shown on research MRI scans that the pain center goes from that the brain activity goes from the pain center, called the nociceptive system, to actually moves over to the emotional center, and the pain center goes dormant. So you have the same back pain, but you have a different driver.
Mm-hmm.
And so when it comes chronic, which my practice is a complex spine practice, most of my patients have chronic problems, the first step I do is say, look, just you need to learn about chronic pain. It's not the same entity as acute pain. So what I do, I give them my book. And the reason why I wrote the book, because I could not really explain this in the office. So I give my book. I have a website that matches the book. And then I say, I'll see you back in 2 weeks. And I ask them to engage in a couple basic exercises called expressive writing, combined with a very simple mindfulness exercise, just to start calming down the nervous system. And then we focus on sleep. And those three things are sort of a big deal to get started. But I say, look, the first month here is just homework. You have to understand the problem before you can solve it. And so it's been consistent. We've watched hundreds of patients go to pain-free, again, including myself. And it's been a very consistent process. And then it's very much self-directed. I work with a pain specialist, and I also do it myself, of course, at times. But yeah, it's been very, very consistent. Once people understand the problem, they can figure it out very, very quickly.
So what sort of exercises do you recommend?
So there's on the website and in the book, which they match each other, the stage one is laying the foundation, which consists of sleep number one, is called therapeutic writing, combined with active meditation. And the three things we're trying to accomplish is to de-adrenalize the nervous system. The second thing is to create new pathways around the pain pathways. The third thing is to shift from pain pathways onto non-painful pathways. So the number one thing is sleep. There's a study out of Israel that's a 4-year large study, prospective, that showed that lack of sleep actually induces chronic pain. In other words, I always thought that people in chronic pain couldn't sleep because of the pain.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out to be the other way around, that it's lack mm-hmm. of sleep induces chronic pain. And they simply did not find the reverse causation. Now, there's other papers that imply that chronic pain causes lack of sleep. But this is a very well-done study done prospectively, and I hadn't even really thought that was a possibility. So the whole project started years ago when I had to read a book about William Dement, who started the sleep lab process out of Stanford. He wrote a book called The Promise of Sleep. He pointed out that most physicians don't address sleep, and I go, well, I can do this. So as a surgeon, I just became very aggressive with the surgical approach to saying, look, you're going to get to sleep. So I would put people on pretty strong medications, and within 2 to 4 weeks, everybody was able to sleep. If they mm-hmm. didn't, I would send them right to the sleep people and get them
make
to sleep.
Make sure they didn't have sleep apnea, yeah.
Right, yeah, we'd do a whole sleep workup, and it was remarkable that probably 20% of my patients just with adequate sleep would have their pain disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So sleep's number one. I keep telling people that without sleep, the entire process simply doesn't work. And there's many ways of getting people to sleep, but that's always the number one thing addressed in addition to learning about the pain. The second thing, there's a exercise called therapeutic or expressive writing, which has been researched now in over 300 papers starting in 1982. It's simply writing down your thoughts and tearing them up somehow breaks up these circuits. And it's remarkable. And I honestly have had essentially every patient that's gone to pain-free has started with this exercise. And it's not the solution, but it is the foundation of the entire project. And with neuroplasticity, you have to become aware of the automatic survival response before you can substitute a new response. So the sequence is awareness, separation, and reprogramming. And what I think the writing does is that your thoughts are just thoughts. And humans have a problem in that they cannot escape their thoughts. So what the writing does is they write down thoughts. They can be positive or negative, rational or irrational. Write them down 5, 10, 15 minutes, and you tear them up. And I have people tear them up for two reasons. One of them is to write with freedom. It's important to simply write what you think. And then if you start analyzing these, quote, issues that come up on paper, they're not issues. They're just thoughts. So if you want to analyze and dwell on these issues on this piece of paper, you're actually reinforcing the circuits. And since the unconscious brain is a million times stronger than the conscious brain, it's literally like putting your hand right into a hornet's nest, and you reinforce the circuits. So the writing does an awareness and separation in one step. There's a space between you and the piece of paper. That space is connected with vision and feel, which is part of the unconscious part of the brain. Then the reprogramming tool can be almost anything, good music, visualization, good wine, whatever you want to do, meditation to reprogram becomes very powerful. But if you don't connect those tools with a separation process, then you end up doing battle with these pathways, which you cannot win. Mm. So meditation by itself works much better with combined with this simple expressive writing exercise. But yeah, the research is very, very deep on this.
That's fascinating. And then the rest of the program?
So there's basically, so the first stage is the sleep, the expressive writing. Then you combine expressive writing, and the basic reprogramming tool is what I call active meditation, which is basically a very abbreviated form of mindfulness. And what you do instead of, if you have unpleasant thoughts or chronic pain or whatever you have, what you're doing instead of fighting these pain circuits is simply put your brain on a different sensation. For instance, right now, just feel yourself sitting and feel the back of the chair, or I'm feeling my elbow on the table, or you can listen to sounds, taste your food. And it just lasts for 3 to 5 seconds. We actually do this in surgery all day long. If you're a little bit frustrated, we just simply go to light, touch, and feel. You start connecting to the environment. When you're connected to the environment, you're off of the pathways. So instead of doing battle with these things, you should be shifted a different direction. So again, the writing does the awareness and separation. Then this little mindfulness exercises switches sensory input. And just that little starting point makes a huge difference. So between sleep, the expressive writing, the active meditation, things start to change pretty quickly. And then the final thing in this stage one is I have people simply not talk about their pain. And it's surprising, I didn't realize this until a few years ago, is that when people are in chronic pain, and this is very understandable, is that people want to talk about it. And what happens, you eventually become somewhat socially isolated or end up connecting with other people in pain. And of course, you just reinforce the pathways. So when I put on workshops and seminars, one of the basic ground rules that we have with the workshop is simply not discussing your pain or your medical care. And actually not complaining at all. And so you don't want to reinforce those circuits. So that's sort of the stage one, and maybe 4 to 6 weeks of that. Things really happen in stage two, which again is around awareness, separation, and reprogramming. But stage two is about forgiveness. And I came across this by accident about 6 years ago, where a patient brought in a book from Stanford called Forgive for Good by Dr. Fred Luskin. And basically, he did four major research projects on forgiveness, about the neurophysiology of forgiveness. And if you're angry at the person or situation that caused your pain originally, you're basically totally connected to that situation, connected to the pain. Mm-hmm. Your body's really adrenalized. And forgiveness has nothing to do with liking the person or letting the person off of the hook. It's about taking your life back. Mm-hmm. And two of the projects he did were with the parents of children who had been murdered. And, you know, having your child murdered by somebody is an intense experience. obviously have a legitimate reason to be angry, but that murderer has also taken your life because your whole life is consumed with this anger. So it's about letting yourself off the hook and enjoying your life. It's not about liking that person. It's not a religious connotation. It's really somewhat of a selfish act to just take your life back and realize it's done, and I still get to enjoy my life. But as you do that, your body's adrenaline really drops, and that's when people really go to pain-free, is when they cross that anger threshold. So the forgiveness is becoming aware of the depth of your anger and frustration. You're truly letting it go. This is not an intellectual exercise. Then we combine that with play. And I realized about 5 years ago in my own journey that pain pathways are permanent, but so are play pathways. And the most powerful way to actually come out of pain pathways is reconnect with play pathways. And it's not obsessive play to, again, do battle with the circuits. The better word might be playful, of just enjoying what you do, enjoying work, enjoying your colleagues, enjoying your patients, whatever you want. Just simply make a decision to enjoy what you're doing. Now, if something's bad or adverse, you don't have to enjoy it, but you don't have to dwell on it either. So it's a matter of just moving forward and experiencing life, and that's been by far the most powerful way of moving forward, is just reconnecting with those pathways. But
yeah, Edgar Cayce said, mind is the builder and the physical is the result.
Right.
So obviously what you concentrate on and think about, and especially combined with strong emotion, will eventually settle into the physical.
Right. Now, the thing is, what's fascinating with medical school, I mean, we're taught basic physiology and all the different changes that occur in the body to adapt to the environment, and it's way more logical to consider most of the symptoms in the body as a result of chemical changes, not a structural problem.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you're angry and frustrated, I mean, your body is really boiling, and there's over 30 symptoms that occur with an over-adrenalized nervous system, which I, again, did not know about till about 2011. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Schubner wrote a book called Unlearn Your Pain. He lists 33 different symptoms of having an adrenalized nervous system. Now, I had 16 of those at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I had migraine headaches, ringing in my ears, burning in my feet, extreme anxiety, insomnia, burning in my feet. These skin rashes would pop up all over my body, then go away.
Mm-hmm.
My scalp would itch. And I had no idea what was going on. And so once I crossed my own anger, frustration threshold, which I did very poorly, by the way, but somehow I got through that, and within 6 weeks, my symptoms started to disappear.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been pain-free pretty much for about 10 years, except, as my wife aptly points out, when I stop my own expressive writing, within about 2 weeks, my symptoms come back. So these little skin rashes pop up on my wrist, my feet start to burn, my ears start to ring, and mm-hmm. I've not found a shortcut. And most of my patients that have successfully dealt with the chronic pain have found the same experience. So there's
Can I add something?
Sure.
To this? You know, I deal a lot with women with mold in their breast implants.
Right.
And like I said before, when you get stressed out, you become more acidic, and your immune system goes down. Your T-cell immunity goes down because
right.
your cortisol levels go up. And
right.
so if you have mold or yeast in your body, that mold and yeast will grow. Now, the symptoms of mold, biotoxin disease, because 1/4 of the population can't get rid of the biotoxin, is burning of your feet, anxiety, headaches, nausea, and blurred vision. Now, what's interesting is if you measure the urine pH, you'll probably be able to show that they're more acidic. If you do a visual contrast sensitivity test, you'll be able to see if they have mold biotoxins, if that's consistent with mold biotoxins. And, you know, if basically what you're doing with your treatment is getting the immune system back up, and then probably getting them back to a normal acid-alkaline balance so that these symptoms go away. But I think a lot of your thing is mediated by mold overgrowth. I really do.
Yeah, no, I don't disagree. I mean, this is all evolving pretty quickly. Can I ask you, by the way, how you came to this particular perspective? I mean, because you're a plastic surgeon, correct?
Well, and I had leaking. Well, I had Dow Corning silicone gel implants.
Okay.
And one side leaked 30 grams, just one side. So
okay. All
the symptoms were on one side. Now, 100% of women with defective silicone implants develop yeast overgrowth.
Okay.
And that's basically fatigue, muscle-like mental clouding.
Okay.
That's not the neurological symptoms that you see with mold.
Right.
They're different.
Okay.
But anyway, I got the yeast symptoms. And then
right.
I got them out and had saline put back in.
Right.
And then at 10 years, those started to leak, and I got mold. So I experienced it myself, just like you did. But what we see is intense mold in the chest wall, obviously.
Okay.
You know, it's not just a little bit of mold growing in the body. It's like a lot of mold in the saline and the chest wall. So we treat with antifungals, and we see all these symptoms go away because we're treating the mold, and we do a detox using mold Sporox to get the mold biotoxins out of the body.
Okay.
Mold Sporox is a number of different herbal things, but it's primarily echinacea.
Right.
And Welbedix will also get, just like cholestyramine pulls it out, but gives people a lot of symptoms of constipation. Welbedix will pull it out without the symptoms. So I very much understand this constellation of symptoms because mold biotoxins have a very particular, set of symptoms that really nothing else will do. It's insomnia because it depletes melatonin.
Okay.
You drink and pee all the time because ADH is affected. Your hair can start to fall out because your thyroid goes down. You have adrenal fatigue. You get blurred vision. You can get shortness of breath if it's bad enough through decreasing VEGF. Your immune system goes down, you get resistant staph, you can get GI problems. Burning of the feet, that's it. I mean, burning of the feet with these other things is always mold biotoxin. I mean, you can get burning of the feet if you've got something in your spine that's causing a problem with both nerves
right.
going to the feet. But that's rare, as you know.
You know,
usually sciatica is on one side or the other.
Right.
But this constellation of symptoms is mold biotoxin.
So I'm also guessing that you see some nice results.
Oh, we have to rotate antifungals because, of course, there's mold spores and they get resistant. But we rotate them using Lamisil, Nizoral, Sporinox, Vfend, and Posaconazole. And I think we talked earlier, I do a lot of the, we can't get sensitivities on mold. It takes too long to grow out. So
mm-hmm.
I use applied kinesiology to figure out where, which drug they need next, and then I use the I don't usually use Welbedix unless they have environmental mold exposure, but I use Mold Sporox, and Buterin's an interesting supplement. It'll knock the biotoxin off the nerves so that, because the biotoxin is very tiny. It's not a big molecule, but it's very hydrophobic, so it likes nerves. So if the chest wall mold is only on the left, all the neurological symptoms will be on the left, including the heart arrhythmias, because the heart is a lot of nerves, right?
Right.
And when we manipulate the implant in surgery, the heart will go into arrhythmias.
Huh.
Isn't that fascinating? Yeah.
Interesting.
But if it's on the right side, it won't because it's not near the heart. It stays on the same side. And so the visual contrast sensitivity test is only abnormal on the right side if only the right implants affected with mold.
Right.
But, you know, a lot of, you need to look at alkalinity because you can use alkaline water. Your patients can buy alkaline water tubes or alkaline water machines, test their urine pH, and then use buffer pH to get their, you don't want to be too alkaline and get kidney stones, but you want to go back up to between 7 and 7.5 because mold doesn't grow there.
Okay.
And then in bad cases, like if it doesn't resolve, with treatment, then you can give antifungals, and it'll resolve a lot quicker. And Lamisil is only $4 at Walmart, so it's not that if the patient doesn't have insurance, you can
right.
still get these antifungals fairly inexpensively.
Yeah. Well, the part that's fun, and I'm guessing you're having the same experience, that when I was just a surgeon, so my choice is how many back pain I could do, physical therapy, injections, or surgery. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of tedious. You know, it first of all, it doesn't work very well. And second of all, it just becomes very tedious. And so what's happened is patients take control of their own care. Why mm-hmm. you have an infinite number of things to do. Because, as you know, medicine in some ways is mind-numbing repetition. And what makes medicine really interesting are the patients. You know, everybody has a different story. They have different situations. And so when you're dealing with sleep, with stress, with physical conditioning, diet, exercise, the different things you're talking about, mm-hmm. you know, all of a sudden you have an infinite number of combinations of things to do. And then when the patient becomes in charge or takes responsibility or ownership of their own problem, you know, they own it, and then you can guide them and help them become more of a cheerleader rather than trying, quote, doing something all the time. So we're just having our team is just having the best time with this. We're watching endless number of patients get better. Everybody mm-hmm. does it completely differently, you know, because everybody's life is, of course, completely different. So by having way more choices of things to do that actually work, it's just the whole practice of medicine, I think, just becomes infinitely more enjoyable. Of course, it's fun watching people get better, too.
Yeah, and one thing you need to make sure of is that they don't have a mold exposure in their house, because
right.
that'll keep them sick.
Interesting.
And back pain is one of the symptoms of mold biotoxin disease.
Okay.
So, and also muscle aches. I mean, the muscles don't work very well at all. So they can get mold test kits. They can... sometimes the mold's in their car, sometimes it's in their house. More often than anything, it's at their workplace.
Mm-hmm.
Most schools have mold, so teachers are exposed. And most government buildings have mold. You know, the older buildings have mold, and apartments have mold, you know,
uh-huh.
especially public housing. Almost
right.
100% of public housing has mold, in
right.
my experience, you know,
wow.
unless it's new. So, getting away from the mold is critical. If they don't respond to what you're doing, think about mold in their environment.
Because
okay. it's not that there's mold in their body per se, but they're breathing the biotoxin in.
Right. Interesting. Okay.
And they will not get better. You remember in the old days that doctors used to send people to Arizona to retire, you know, or if they were chronically ill?
Right.
That's because Arizona doesn't have mold.
Interesting.
It really is. I mean, I guess you can have mold in your house in Arizona if you have a water intrusion problem. But in general, compared to Georgia and Florida and Louisiana and Texas, Arizona doesn't have mold.
Huh. Interesting.
They
now,
got better.
I'm excited to talk to a surgeon who sort of looks at the whole perspective. It's not the way we're trained exactly. And I give a lecture all over the country about enjoying the management of chronic pain. And when I give mm-hmm. lectures to physicians, why I ask them, you know, how many of you enjoy treating chronic pain? And essentially nobody in the room raises their hand. It's not because they don't like people with chronic pain. We just don't know what to do. And you have to get the correct
right.
diagnosis, of course, before you can treat the problem. And if you're dealing with other issues besides, and again, we're focused on structural issues, where it's the body's reaction to the structural issues or just the environment that
mm-hmm.
creates the symptoms. And so, you know, probably 95% of all bodily symptoms create chemical changes, and those are physical symptoms. Those are not psychological symptoms. And so to
mm-hmm.
me, it's a neurological process, again, affecting the immune system, et cetera, that creates the symptoms. And so it's interesting how medicine has just really become focused on structural, and that's just part of the problem.
Yeah, I mean, structural is understandable. If you're in a high-speed car accident, obviously things are going to get knocked out of whack, you know. And I've seen people come in, you know, that have chronic pain for, say, 7 months after a car wreck, and they finally get to me because of a scar.
Right.
And I look at them and I go see a chiropractor, and then one chiropractic adjustment, they're out of pain.
Right.
You know, I mean, that really does happen.
Yep.
So, you know, there's usually a history of trauma if
right.
there's going to be a major structural problem.
Right.
And, of course, as you said, we've all had the experience or heard of people who were treated with chronic pain for, you know, for 6 months and then nobody ever got an x-ray and they have a metastatic lesion,
right.
You know, that's something you really have to rule out quickly.
Right.
But there's also infection causing, bacterial infection causes back pain.
Right.
I'm sure you've read those studies.
Right.
That's fascinating, you know, and it responds to antibiotics.
Right.
So, decreased energy in an area, okay, decreased energy in the lower back. For some reason, financial problems can decrease the energy in the lower back, and then that makes it more prone to infection. It may make the whole body more prone to yeast and mold overgrowth.
Right.
And then, you know, you get all the muscle problems because you have severe magnesium deficiency with yeast overgrowth. And muscle issues are very critical for neck and back pain. As
right.
I agree with you. You've got to rebalance magnesium and get the muscles working again so they're not in spasm.
Right. Huh, interesting.
100% of my patients with yeast and mold have muscle aches and muscle spasms, 100%.
Right.
And I can even treat the yeast and the mold successfully, but if I don't replace magnesium malic acid, then they'll still have muscle aches, you see?
Gotcha.
They have a chronic magnesium deficiency and malic deficiency, and that's Krebs cycle. Both magnesium and malate are needed in the Krebs cycle. So a lot of times you have to optimize the Krebs cycle to get out of muscle pain.
Well, one of the reasons I'm so on fire with this project right now is I've done spine surgery for 30 years. So I'm listening to you, and, you know, each person has different things to decrease the pain, and it's an evolving process. I mean, there's so much we don't know. It's unbelievable. But what's difficult in my spine surgery world is that people have symptoms just like you described. They've not been looked at as far as sleep stress, the different imbalances you just talked about. And then what we're doing is literally on the first visit recommending a spine fusion for back pain. And the success rate of a spine fusion for back pain is about 22 to 24%, which is not very high. When I came in on my fellowship, I thought that the success rate for a spine fusion for back pain was over 90%. Otherwise, why would you do it? And then a paper came out in 1993 out of the state of Washington in workers' comp. They found out that the return to work rate 1 year after a spine fusion for back pain was 15%, 1-5. And at 2 years, it was 22%. If you didn't have surgery, the return to work rate was double. So that's why I just quit doing fusions for back pain.
Mm-hmm.
Then as my practice evolved, people have these fusions for back pain. And again, it can be some type of chemical imbalance, immune system, whatever it is. And so we're doing a structural procedure with very poor outcomes for a physiologic problem.
Mm-hmm.
And then in 2006, a paper came out of Stanford, again, showing the same thing, that when you had a fusion for back pain in a very, very carefully controlled prospective study, the success rate at 2 years out was 24%. So right now, there's over 300,000 fusions a year being done for back pain. It was happened the
no
last...
No wonder the cost of medicine's out of control, huh?
It's horrible. And then my problem is that you have a fusion done at L4-5, for instance, and then a year or two later, of course, the back pain hasn't resolved, right?
Well, sometimes it's worse.
Well, actually, that shows it does get worse 40% of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Then L3-4 breaks down, and then L2-3 breaks down. And then I have one gentleman who has now had 29 operations in 20 years. He's fused from his neck to his pelvis. He's had 4 major postoperative infections and revisions, and his entire life is taken away.
Yeah.
I have another nurse who had she had 10 operations in 7 years. Another guy had 18 operations in 48 months. And
in plastic surgery, we know not to go in for at least 6 months to a year because of the scar tissue, you know?
What's the background of that?
Well, scar tissue. If you go in too soon, the scar tissue goes crazy.
Really?
Because of yeast and mold in the scar tissue.
Okay.
Hypertrophic scars are due to infection, bacteria, yeast, and mold.
Okay. Interesting.
These
and
people probably already have that, in their
pain,
body.
Are those painful? When we say scars,
yeah,
you mean painful scars?
Yeah, that painful scar is infected scar, right.
So if you treat the scars with your approach, they often avoid the surgery. Is that what I hear you saying?
No, I think you've got to pre-treat with whatever antifungals and antibiotics they test for.
Uh-huh.
And then a lot of times we have to go in and cut out the scar tissue because the scar tissue doesn't allow the antifungals into it.
Right.
So, you know, I mean, that's why cancer doesn't lives in scar tissue, obviously.
Right.
Because the immune system can't get to it. So if there's a lot of scar tissue, cutting the scar tissue out is a good thing.
Right.
But you don't want to go in when the scar tissue is fresh because it's still probably infected or contaminated. It might not be infected. It's contaminated.
Right.
With these fungal elements, you know, you can't see them. You can't. You just know that the scar is painful.
Right.
Or burning pain. Burning pain is usually mold. That's what, you know, we talk about nerve pain, burning pain. A lot of times that's infected nerves. I've had treated a number of patients with trigeminal neuralgia.
Okay.
They have mold in their sinuses. I treat them with, like, nasal antifungals or regular antifungals and clear out their sinuses, and their trigeminal pain goes away. If you ever see twitching, you know, twitching of the lower eyelid, that means you have mold biotoxins.
Okay.
Twitching anywhere is mold.
Okay. I'm curious.
Doctors don't know that.
At some point, I spent 20 years of my practice doing just surgery, essentially, and then I sort of evolved into this whole process. And I'm guessing you went through a phase where you were doing basically surgery, then evolved into this process. So I'm curious about your experience about what your practice was like before you took a multi-pronged approach versus doing just surgery.
Well, I would say because I was born with intuitive skills, I would know causation more than, say, the average doctor would.
Okay.
Does that make sense? I would be guided intuitively to understand causation, which I think is something that a lot of really good doctors do.
Right.
I mean, I had a friend who was a general surgeon, and he said to me, he said, I found this patient with tubercular peritonitis, and he said, I knew they had tuberculosis before I opened them. I said, how did you know that? I said, did you ever see tubercular peritonitis? And he says, no. I go, well, how'd you know that? He said, I just knew it. So that has to be intuition.
Right.
Because how common is tubercular peritonitis? I mean,
I honestly never heard of that, to be honest.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, you as an orthopedic surgeon, did you ever see tubercular infection in a joint?
No.
I have. When I was in orthopedics, we drained an abscess in his shoulder, and it was tuberculosis.
Okay.
So tuberculosis doesn't have to occur just in the lung.
Right.
It can occur in a joint. It can occur in the peritoneum. You know, we don't know this because obviously tuberculosis, except maybe in third world countries, is pretty well controlled, although we've had more trouble with it now because of the resistances.
Right.
But the point is, this particular surgeon had wonderful intuition.
Right.
He knew, I mean, he was being guided by his spiritual team. And so when he went in, he made sure that he did tubercular cultures, okay? Because obviously to make that diagnosis, you're going to have to do the right culture.
Right.
It's just an example. And many surgeons are very, very intuitive.
Right.
But that's how you know you're intuitive, because you do stuff that is totally not common and not, I mean, you do it with guidance, and it's not something you routinely do.
Well,
and you get the right answer, you know, you diagnose it so you can treat it.
Well, I'm sort of thinking out loud here, but, you know, one of the problems with modern medicine is that it's become the business of medicine, which means you're sort of push hard to see patients, you know, move forward quickly.
They try to cookbook everything, you know that.
Right. So by not having the time to actually talk to patients, I mean, to be intuitive, you actually have to talk to your patients and and experience them a bit. And I have started a national campaign focused on the word listen. I mean, I think that the treatment of choice for chronic disease is to listen to our patients. Mm-hmm. And like you pointed out, people have financial stresses, all sorts of things going on in their lives, mm-hmm. which may sound irrelevant, but like you pointed out, it changes the body's chemistry, it changes the immune system. So unless you understand the patient's entire situation, you just don't know what's going on. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't take that long. I mean, it's not like it's a super time-consuming process for the patient or the doctor.
Right.
But by just listening a little bit, things change dramatically. And then mm-hmm. unfortunately right now, like I said before, you have a bone spread that's been there for years. All of a sudden it becomes symptomatic under stress. And, you know, again, the etiology of that, whether it's mold or adrenaline, cortisol, et cetera, you have to know what it is. But what we're doing is we're throwing a procedure at them and adding another stress that has a low chance of working. So then they've had the procedure. Now they have more pain, and they're in this cycle of downward mm-hmm. spiraling. And with the business of medicine being so efficient, I feel like we're really hurting our population very quickly. I think it's really a problem.
Yep.
So, yeah, it's to me it's incredibly encouraging to hear your approach and outlook. I just have not, and I think I agree with you, surgeons are intuitive, and I think that they want to do the right things. We do not like bad outcomes, as you well know.
No, not at all.
But we're, the business of medicine has sort of taken away our capacity to have the time to listen to our patients. And that's a big problem. But
There's two things you can do for your patient's immune system that would be helpful. One is to get their vitamin D level between 50 and 100 with D3.
Okay.
And there's a serum D3 that can be used to do that easily. It's got 2,200 drops per unit. I'm sorry, 2,200 units per drop.
Okay.
And if you take two dropperfuls of that, you'll wipe out the flu. I mean, if you have the flu or catching the flu, you take two dropperfuls of this, the flu's gone. So just remember that. But high vitamin D levels keep the T-cell immunity healthy. It decreases your risk of cancer, viruses, and yeast and mold. So that's important for these patients. The other thing I would recommend is ImmunoGPRP. That's a great immune supplement that is colostrum-based and will increase IgE in the sinuses and the respiratory tract, the GI tract, and the urinary tract. And a lot of yeast and mold is in that one of those systems, as you can imagine. Mold in the sinuses is very common. Mold in the lungs is very common. So increasing the IgE through that immune supplement is very effective in protecting your patients.
Okay. Gotcha. Interesting.
Well, the immune system is being knocked down by the chronic toxicity in our environment, air pollution, toxic chemicals, heavy metals.
Right.
Arsenic in the chicken and rice, All of this is taking a toll on immunity.
Right. Well, it's interesting because when you're under chronic stress, while, of course, your body's adrenaline goes up, also your cortisol levels go up. And what I've learned, I don't quite understand this, maybe you have the answer for this, is that cortisol is anti-inflammatory, which actually helps the immune system in a way, but somehow the body develops a tissue resistance to cortisol. So that part I haven't quite understood yet about that tissue resistance to cortisol.
Well, I can actually explain it because I did endocrine research at Hopkins and Wash U.
Okay.
When you have high levels of any hormone,
the
body produces a lot of receptors.
Okay.
So it's not just the level of the hormone you have to look at. It's how many receptors.
Okay.
Okay. And so that's a lot of things that it really isn't taught in medical school, so doctors don't understand that. But remember when you learned about feedback loops?
Right.
You have your hypothalamic, your pituitary, and then your organ, thyroid, adrenal, whatever, the end organ of the endocrine system.
Right.
Mold and yeast disrupt the hypothalamic aspect. So often the levels are normal. But I check the basal metabolic temp, which is much more accurate. And usually if it's below 97.5, you're going to have a problem with your thyroid. But it's at the hypothalamic level.
Okay.
And we use a substance called a supplement called Indipath F to straighten out the hypothalamus.
Okay.
And it affects sex hormones too, but... Of course, you get adrenal fatigue, you get all the thyroid symptoms, you drink and pee all the time. If your patients are drinking and peeing all the time, you can be pretty sure they have yeast or mold.
Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. Well, we're coming up on the end of our hour. Would you like to give your contact information?
Yeah, my I have a website. It is backincontrol.com, just one word, backincontrol.com. And the book is Back in Control, A Surgeon's Roadmap Out of Chronic Pain. And the website basically is the action plan of the book. It's about a 90% self-directed process. The three parts of getting better is becoming aware of the problem. The second part is treating every aspect at the same time. And again, I've learned a lot today about some other area that I was not aware of. And then the third thing is the patient takes control of his or her own care. So the awareness, treating every aspect at the same time, and taking control of the three aspects of healing. And then everybody's different. There's many variables to be dealt with, and it's just not a simplistic solution. So, yeah, between the book and the website, it's been very consistent, very much of a self-directed process. And I've just had the best time of my career watching this whole thing take place. It's been extremely rewarding.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. I do want to remind the public that your doctor may not know much about yeast or mold. Mold is politically incorrect because if the government and corporations were held responsible for the mold in their buildings that are making people sick, it would be very expensive for them. It's very expensive to clean mold up. So that most doctors who published in that field have lost their medical licenses. So I just want to remind them that their doctors may not understand this, but if they go to integrative holistic doctors, they do understand it. So keep that in mind if you feel like you have one of these problems. And thanks so much for joining us, Dr. Hamskin. It's been a wonderful interview, and good luck with your work. It's
real important.
Yeah, thank
you.
Important.
Likewise for yourself. Yeah, very impressed.
Take care.
All right.
This
you
is
too.
Dr. Susan Cobb with Temple of Health Radio Show. We will be back next week with Dr. Love, Healing the Emotional Component, and then The Invisible Crime, Michael Bell. We're going to be talking about electronic torture chips and how that may be the invisible crime in our society. Thank you very much for joining us. This is Dr. Susan Cobb with Temple of Health Radio Show.